A science story, huh?
Is NYU scientist the...
I felt right.
I figured it out.
It was that golden moment.
Because science was on my side.
Hey everyone, I'm Ben Lilly, and welcome to the Story Collider, where we bring you true stories of how science has affected people's lives. For August, we're taking our summer break, so we're rerunning some favorites you may not have heard the first time around. This week's story is from David Morgan. The story was recorded in April 2011 at Pacific Standard in Brooklyn. The theme of the night was science fiction.
I want to talk about Carl Sagan tonight, and I'm assuming I don't have to explain who Carl Sagan is to this crowd in particular, right? In keeping with tonight's theme, he did write some science fiction. He wrote the book Contact, later made into a film with Jodie Foster, but he's most known for his 13-part PBS series, Cosmos. Just by round of applause, how many people have seen all 13 episodes of Carl Sagan's Cosmos? A few, yeah, most. How many people watched Cosmos in 1980 or 1981? Ah, some old people here, that's great. I'm glad I'm not the only one. I saw Carl Sagan for the first time in 1981, and I'm 41 now, which would have made me about 11, 12 years old when I first saw Cosmos. As Ben said, I am a physicist. I would like to be able to say that I owe that all to Carl Sagan, that when I saw Cosmos for the first time, I decided then and there that I wanted to be a scientist. But that would actually not be true. When I saw Cosmos, I was already in 7th or 8th grade. I knew I was going to be a scientist by the time I was a 3rd grader. By the end of 2nd grade, I checked out the entire 500 Dewey Decimal System from my school library, to the point where once the school librarian bodily took me by the shoulders to the fiction section and tried to force me to check out a storybook. Let's just say she was not successful. I wasn't interested in fiction. I was interested in stories. I wasn't even interested in science fiction. I was interested in science fact. So by the time I saw Cosmos in 7th grade, it was clear that I was well on the way to being a scientist. Now, I know that I saw Cosmos not the first time it ran, which was 1980, because I distinctly remember lots of pledge breaks. So I know that PBS was trying to capitalize on the success of the first run of Cosmos by running it again with lots of pledge breaks. But I know I saw it before 1982, because I know we had cable when I saw Cosmos. And I know we had cable before 82, because that's when MTV started. And I remember the promos for MTV, like, before it started. So I figured out that the time I saw Cosmos was right around 1981. And the reason I know that we had cable when I watched Cosmos for the first time is because I was not allowed to watch Cosmos on the good TV with the cable. I had to watch Cosmos in the back room, in the busted-ass black-and-white TV with the UHF antenna. Because my mother referred to Cosmos as the most boring goddamn thing I have ever seen on television. My mom's a born-again Christian now. She would never use the Lord's name in vain, but this is late 70s chain-smoking mom, so she was a completely different. She said, you know, I'm not watching that crap. Go in the back room. MASH is new tonight, right? So I had to watch Cosmos in the back room. So I would go back at 7:30, and I would fuss with the UHF antenna so I'd have a decent picture by 8 o'clock. And Cosmos would come on, and there's this guy, this sort of brilliant doofus guy, and he's talking about Heike Krebs and Champollion, and he's talking about the Drake equation and the fourth dimension and whale songs, and just my mind is blown. There's so much going on, and I decide right then and there, not just that I want to be a scientist, but I want to be that guy. I want to be that actual, because Carl Sagan was the first scientist I'd ever really seen, so he becomes sort of the archetype for me of what a scientist is. And archetypes are funny things because they're sort of subconscious, and even today, more than 20 years later, I will sometimes, while I'm teaching, find myself, I mean, I don't really do a Carl Sagan impersonation or anything, but I'll find myself pausing and enunciating in a very particular way for emphasis and gesturing with my hands when I teach. And it's probably fairly subtle. My students probably don't notice it, but I notice it. And it's nice when it happens. I kind of enjoy it when it happens. And so there's that. And there's another thing that I attribute to Carl Sagan, and it can really only be described as a bizarre blazer fetish. And I didn't realize I had a problem. And it's not a sexual thing, but I didn't realize I had a problem until about 2 years ago when I was looking around my office, and I was looking at all the furniture, and hanging over the back of every piece of furniture in the office, there was a blazer, and I counted, and there were 5 blazers in the office, and I only teach 4 days a week. So I looked around, and I don't know what it is. It's just something about, I see one in the menswear department, and I can't resist. There's just this idea that if you're explaining the secrets of the universe to a group full of young people, you gain some sort of additional cred if you do it in a sort of ill-fitting corduroy blazer. So it's a weakness that I have. So that was 1980-1981. The real story begins in around 1995. Many years later, I'm in graduate school. I'm getting my PhD in theoretical physics at the College of William & Mary in Virginia. And I'm sort of living the dream. I'm actually becoming an honest-to-goodness scientist at this point. And in 1995, Carl Sagan released a book called The Demon-Haunted World, A Science as a Candle in the Dark. If you don't know the book is sort of a skepticism manifesto. Carl Sagan in this book sort of explains why you shouldn't really believe anything unless it's been proven scientifically. So ESP, UFOs, God, Bigfoot, they're all the same to Carl Sagan. They're on the same category. They're all things that you should be skeptical of. And Carl Sagan is sort of ranting in one section of this book about the role that television plays in the miseducation of the American public. Because in the late 1970s, there are a lot of these sort of unsolved mystery shows, like In Search Of. And Carl Sagan is sort of railing against these shows. And there's a section in The Demon-Haunted World, and I have a copy of the first edition here that I checked from the NYU library. And he says, for example, there's a series called The X-Files, which pays lip service to skeptical examination of the paranormal, but is skewed heavily towards the reality of alien abductions and strange powers and government complicity in covering up just about anything interesting. Almost never does the paranormal claim turn out to be a hoax or a psychological aberration or a misunderstanding of the natural world. Much closer to reality, as well as a much greater public service, would be a television series in which paranormal claims are systematically investigated and every case is found to be explicable in prosaic terms. But unfortunately, no such show exists. And I read that, and I thought to myself, I don't know, Carl. I think you're wrong about that. I think that a show very much like that exists. In fact, I think if what you're looking for is a show in which paranormal claims are shown again and again to be explicable in prosaic terms as misunderstandings of the natural world, even as long ago as the late 1970s, there was a show that happened every single episode. Scooby-Doo. Think about it. In every episode of Scooby-Doo, every werewolf, every phantom, every sea monster is shown to be an old man, usually the caretaker of an abandoned amusement park or a ski lodge, wearing a rubber mask. And it's always clear at the end of the episode that the talking dog and the hippie are idiots for ever having believed anything otherwise. What is that if not an education in skepticism in the face of the unexplained? So I thought about this, and it gave me a little chuckle, but it didn't end there, because I thought to myself, Carl Sagan needs to know about this. I don't know if it because it was grad school and I was stressed out, I needed something to occupy my brain, but I started scheming ways that I could get in touch with Carl Sagan to let him know about this glaring omission from The Demon-Haunted World. And the first thought was, well, I'll write him a letter sort of care of his publisher. But I realized, nah, Carl Sagan probably gets a lot of crazy letters from people, you know, people who say they've been abducted by UFOs and fundamentalist young earth creationist Christians railing against his book. I don't want it to go into the crazy pile with a bunch of crazy letters. I want it to be opened by actually Carl Sagan and not a publisher. So I try to think, well, nowadays the answer would be email, right? You just send an email. But this was 1995, and it wasn't quite guaranteed yet that everybody had an email address. So I'm thinking, and the idea I come up with is a fax. Because a fax somehow seems serious to me, like it would be taken. Like, crazy people don't have faxes, right? So I decide I'm going to send a fax to Carl Sagan, and this is the fax that I sent. I said, Dear Dr. Sagan, in your recent book, The Demon-Haunted World, you made the following comment on the treatment of the paranormal on American television, much closer to reality, blah, 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 explicable in prosaic terms. But there was just such a show, Scooby-Doo. Don't you remember? Every episode demonstrated conclusively that all those ghosts, sea monsters, and werewolves were really just old men wearing masks, parentheses, and I would have gotten away with it too if it weren't for you meddling kids. Apparently it just wasn't enough. Dave Morgan, Department of Physics, College of William and Mary. And I figured, well, look, as long as I got my childhood science hero on the, you know, as long as I got his attention, I should say something, I mean, without getting all gushy and fanboy, I should say something personal. So I said, P.S., I'm a longtime fan of your books and I'm enjoying your latest. Keep up the good work and rest assured that it does make a difference. I'm a PhD student and a science educator today, partly because of the influence that Cosmos had on me as a young person. And so I headed downstairs to the departmental office. I faxed this letter to the Cornell University Department of Radio Astronomy. And then I basically forgot about it. I had gotten it out of my head. I didn't really give it much more thought. I went back to being a sort of busy graduate student. I put it aside and forgot about it to such an extent that 2 weeks later, when I got an envelope in my school mailbox from the Cornell Department of Radio Astronomy, I didn't know what it was. I'm like, why is Cornell sending me this thing? Oh my God, it's a letter from Carl Sagan. I mean, it took me a minute to realize what it was. And so I, well, maybe it's, you know, maybe it's just a letter from the departmental secretary, whoever's in charge of opening up letters about 70s cartoon shows. But no, it actually turned out to be an actual letter from Carl Sagan. And it read, "Dear Mr. Morgan, thank you so much for your recent facts. I'm embarrassed because I watch the show with my young son regularly. I will try to include a correction in a future edition of The Demon Haunted World." Carl Sagan's going to change his book because of me. "Warmest regards, Carl Sagan. P.S. I was delighted to read of the influence the cosmos had on you as a young person." So that was the letter I received back from Carl Sagan. And I was pleased that I had made this connection. Look, I didn't really believe that that Carl Sagan was really going to put some bullshit about Scooby-Doo and the demon-haunted world, but it was nice to have made this little sort of connection with my childhood science hero. Although the irony is not lost on me that despite my childhood aversion to fictional stories featuring cartoon animals, that my only interaction with my childhood science hero was about the exploits of a fictional mystery-solving talking dog. 6 months after I received the letter from Carl Sagan, Carl Sagan died due to complications due to myelodysplasia, which is a blood disease similar to leukemia. And I remember quite vividly when I learned of this, because I happened to be at an airport at the time. And I was sitting in the airport, and I can remember the way I was sitting. I can remember where the television was. And I looked up. It was sort of one of these hanging airport televisions, and I saw Carl Sagan's face on the TV. And I thought, well, that's weird. There are no like big space missions going on right now. Why is Carl Sagan on television? And I knew immediately before the crawl came across CNN, because he'd been sick for quite some time. So it was not a surprise in particular. But it was sad, and it was sad in a particularly meaningful way because the reason I was in an airport at that time was that I was coming back from my first conference as a scientist. Since receiving the letter from Carl Sagan 6 months earlier, I'd passed my qualifying exams, I'd started working on a research project with the theory department, and my advisor had sent me to a symposium on relativistic astrophysics in Chicago, where I saw Stephen Hawking speak, and I got to meet with the authors of a paper that we were basing some of our work on. And so I was a real scientist now, and looking up at Carl Sagan on that airport television and thinking about the 11-year-old me looking at Carl Sagan on television in the back room, now I was that scientist, and now that scientist was gone. So I had a little, you know, circle of life moment there in the Chicago O'Hare airport. And it wasn't long until I realized that this probably spelled doom for my Scooby-Doo erratum. But that was okay. You know, I didn't really think much of it anyway. I did, when the paperback version came out, I did check it. I did flip to the page on the X-Files and look. There was nothing there. It was the same as the hardback edition. But I figured that was okay. You know, it could just be mine and Carl's little secret. I thought that was the end of the story until 6 months ago, when I had the idea to do my this story. And so I started preparing the story, and I went looking for the quote from The Demon Haunted World, but I didn't have my copy in the office. But I remembered I had a copy on my hard drive from some BitTorrent of pirated science PDFs that I had downloaded at some point. So I went and opened it up, and I opened the PDF, and it said Demon Haunted World, second paperback printing. And I thought, well, that was interesting. And I opened up the file, and I searched for the X-Files, because I knew he was talking about the X-Files. And I turned to that page in the book, and I read the following. "Almost never does the paranormal claim turn out to be a hoax, or a psychological aberration, or a misunderstanding of the natural world. Much closer to reality, as well as a much greater public service, would be an adult series in which paranormal claims are systematically investigated and every case is found to be explicable in prosaic terms." And then right there in parentheses, "Scooby-Doo does it for children." To which I will just add, Carl Sagan did it for me. Thanks.
That was David Morgan, David holds a PhD in theoretical high-energy physics from the College of William and Mary. He is currently the director of Innovation Lab at Ross at the Ross School, a science and technology academy for high school students. For more science stories, take a look at storycollider.org, where we have archives of the podcast and upcoming events. The Story Collider is produced by me, Brian Wecht, Aaron Barker, and Ari Daniel Shapiro. The podcast is produced by Rose Eveleth. Additional help from Brooke Williams, Lena Groger, and Justin D'Ambrosio. The theme music is by Ghost. Special thanks to Pacific Standard for hosting the show, and to Scooby-Doo for teaching me to always look for the mask. Thanks for listening.